that's how, no.
Right.
If you love music because it's cool, you don't love music. You love cool things. You love cool music and cool motorcycles and cool tattoos. You don't like music. So for me, what I like in music, I like, and I like it on such an instinctive and gut level that I don't even question it.
Welcome to episode 77 of the Bass Shed Podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. Everything you need for the double bass can be found at lemurmusic.com. I'll be hanging with the Lemur folks at the NAMM show this year. I'm actually headed down there next week to check out what's going on. I know they just received the Andreas Martin signature solo bass with an extended fingerboard. I'm interested to play that, actually. Stop by lemurmusic.com. Check out what you're into and use the promo code TheBassShed, all one word, for 10% off. So, as I mentioned on the last episode, I'm personally interested in what the team over at Fine is up to. Fine is a platform for artists to sell their recorded work. The platform is designed to honor the artist's creative and intellectual property. I also mentioned that I'd be keeping you all in the loop. I did sign up for the website. I haven't uploaded any tracks yet because I have to track down what hard drive. I have some older tunes on. From the artist standpoint, the website is laid out in a way that's super user-friendly. It's really easy to navigate. If you have some tracks or an album that you'd like to sell and be compensated more than a streaming service would compensate, head to finay.com, that's F-I-N-A-Y.com, to upload your music. It is free. I received a text message from the guys over at Trickfish sometime last week telling me that they have a new product, the Bullhead Mini 500. The Bullhead Mini 500 is built around the acclaimed Mike Pope designed low noise preamplifier and is a superb 500 watt Class D amplifier. I'm going to try to play through it before the NAMM show and report back to you all about it. Stop by trickfishamps.com, check out their heads, check out their cabinets, and check out their preamps. Use the promo code TheBassShed, all one word, for 10% off. On the episode is bassist and composer Lance Morrison. Lance has been on the show before, so for regular listeners of the Bass Shed podcast, you might remember the chat with Lance on episode 48. For new listeners, Lance has performed and recorded with Rod Stewart, Alanis Morissette, The New Radicals, Leanne Rimes, Rick Springfield, Don Henley, Richard Marx, Volto, The Corrs, Gavin DeGraw, and that's just to name a few. Lance is a member of Mike Campbell's band, The Dirty Knobs. Mike Campbell was the guitarist for the legendary Tom Petty. Lance is currently in between road dates with The Dirty Knobs, so we had a chance to connect and talk about the tour as well as a bunch of interesting topics. I will have a link to The Dirty Knobs website at thebassshed.com/podcast/Lance Morrison 2. That's Lance Morrison, followed by the number 2. Check out their tour dates. It's going to be a great show. The Dirty Knobs is opening up for Chris Stapleton, which I'm a Chris Stapleton fan too. That's going to be a really, really great show. Lance is one of my favorite people to talk to about music and kind of like the psychology of where he's at during a performance or in the studio. It's always a great time to have Lance on the show. And here's my talk with session bassist, touring bassist, and composer Lance Morrison. What's up, man?
How you doing?
Doing good. How you doing?
Doing fine, thank you.
Yeah, been a little while.
It has. When was it?
It was about this. I had to look it up. The last episode came out April 26th.
Oh, okay.
Of last year.
Okay, sure.
So was last year the shutdown year or was it the year before?
Well, kind of both were. 2020 was the shutdown year.
Last year was kind of half. It was like in and out.
Yeah, like around March and April, I think the vaccine started rolling out.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
It's all such a blur, man. Like, who knows? Yeah. But you're out there. You're back doing it again. You're on the road with Dirty Knobs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. In fact, just we're on a little break now, and we're getting back out. Going to be opening up for Chris Stapleton.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, that'll be fun. And in like October and first day of November, we're going to be opening up for The Who, which is,
oh my gosh,
dude, man, it's insane.
Who's playing bass for The Who now? Because I heard Pino left.
Yeah, John Button.
Okay.
Really cool guy.
I don't know too much about him.
He's great.
Yeah. And, I mean,
he's assuming. I guess an LA guy who's just been doing it, you know, just like all of us.
Yeah.
And I also know the keyboard player, Lauren Gold. Really cool guy. So it'll be, I mean, we'll be opening for The Who, but I'll, you know, also be hanging with friends, which will be awesome.
That's amazing. So the last run you did with Dirty Knobs, where were you at?
Kind of all over the US, but it was like we were playing like, you know, clubs and, you know, small theaters and stuff like that, headlining, which was like, we were, you know, we were supposed to be doing this March of 2020, but obviously that got shut down. So finally we had to tour, and we were going to tour on our first record. And in the meantime, we made a second record. So we had two records to support, and it was great. And the crowds were just going nuts.
Yeah.
It was amazing. The first show was in Nashville at the Brooklyn Bowl. And I mean, it was awesome just to get to do that again. And just, you know,
Everybody's happy to be out.
Exactly.
Seeing live music again.
Exactly.
Where's Mike at? Is Mike live in Nashville? Or is he out here?
No, he's out here.
Okay. Nashville seems like a good place for that band.
For Dirty Knobs?
Yeah.
Oh,
You'd be really well received there.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, everywhere we've gone, the reception has been amazing. I mean, the crowds have been awesome, like every single show.
Amazing.
So, yeah. No, it's great. And,
that's cool.
Mike's learning how to be a front man. He's doing a great job. And I mean, the crowds are responding. It's just, it's been a lot of fun.
That's always inspiring when you see a front man who's really great at being a front man, or someone who kind of steps into that role and like quickly adapts to it. I'm starting to check out things about booking tours with this record I have coming out. And like the idea of being a front man kind of freaks me out a little bit.
I hear you. Yeah. I get it.
Yeah. I'd have to prepare a script or just not talk to him and play.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Like, of it is like, what now? Like, I'm comfortable with the music and the dudes, like everything's fine when we play, but now I have to talk. Like,
Everybody's looking at me.
How you doing over there? Table four. All right, cool.
Exactly. No. And Mike, you know, he was always, I mean, obviously he was just the guitar player, in the Heartbreakers, and just always seemed to be, I mean, he always looked like kind of a quiet guy to me. I mean, he would, throw rock shapes and stuff and be a good, guitar player. But it's a whole new thing to be a front man.
Yeah.
And to interact with the audience and get them to participate in songs and stuff. But he's taken to it like a fish to water.
He had one of the best role models.
There is.
I mean,
exactly. Exactly.
I mean, if he just mimicked Petty,
job
done.
I get it. Yeah. No, he seems really comfortable just talking to the audience or in interviews when he's giving interviews. It's fun to watch because he's himself. He's able to be himself during interviews.
Oh, cool.
Which, I mean, I always get so self-conscious and, I'm like, is that the best way to say that? Or did I get something dumb? But
whatever. Yeah, I'd still, even doing this, like I still get in my head pretty much every episode. Like, am I going to say something that pisses somebody off?
Sure. Like,
just don't say what you really think, Ryan, because it'll probably piss somebody off.
That's right.
Just be like, you just popcorn, vanilla popcorn, like no real substance to any of it.
That's fine.
I'll get by all right.
I'll drink to that.
Cheers. Cheers. You're also doing some composing, I remember.
Yeah. Still doing that, although haven't been able to do much of it in the last, this year, just because, I mean, the Knobs rehearsed for a couple of months.
Yeah.
Basically all of January and February, we were just kind of, working through all the songs and stuff like that, getting ready, just getting used to playing again.
Sure.
With each other and just playing live with other people. And then, since March, we've just kind of been, on the road. So there hasn't been a whole lot of composing. I actually need to finish up a couple of tracks before I get back out on the road, in a week and a half. So
what are those for?
It's for a music library.
Okay.
Yeah, indie rock, which is fun.
Yeah.
You know, you can just thrash around and.
Yeah. So how much of that, when it comes to that, what do you do for drums?
It depends. Sometimes we hire drummers.
They go to the studio?
Yeah, the guy that I co-write with, this guy, Dave Feldstein, great, great writer. He can do it all. But usually the way we work is, you know, I'll put the track together and he's an amazing singer.
Okay.
And lyricist and everything. So he'll usually, you know, write and produce the top line. And he's got a great studio in his backyard. I mean, it's amazing.
Nice.
And, you know, has a drum set up there. So yeah. We need drums. We'll usually, you know, get it, you know, at his place.
Okay. Cool. And then you do the rest. You do keys, bass, yeah. Guitar.
Yeah. I mean, I try, you know, if it's a little rough, we try to hire somebody.
Yeah.
Like Bruce Watson is definitely a go-to. Pete Thorne.
Okay.
You know, around, you know, for the more, depending on what it is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But like for basic rhythm stuff, I can usually figure something out. Although okay. I mean, I'm not the greatest guitar player by any means, but you know.
When did you pick that up? When did you like adopt guitar playing into the arsenal? I've thought about it over the years, mainly just to teach it. You know, like if I can get through a couple of Hal Leonard books, I'll teach some 5-year-olds.
Right, right.
You know, on a Wednesday afternoon.
I got an acoustic guitar, like a nylon string guitar, when I was in high school, probably like 10th grade or something like that.
Okay.
My mom probably saw it like, you know, at a garage sale or something. Yeah. Here you go. And I'm like, cool. So I was always messing around with it, but I never like really studied it.
Yeah.
You know, I'd write songs on it or whatever and mess around. So, but I have zero real guitar chops, you know, at all. It's just, I mean, my one chop is, you know,
my one chop. I have one chop.
No, but it is. It's like, or my favorite thing to do is just, like, you know, drop D tuning and then just move your finger up and down the fretboard. It's like, sure. Yeah, and throw a lot of distortion on it. That I can do really well.
Yeah, let's rock.
Yeah, any kind of like eighth note-y rhythm stuff I can usually get, and just the simplest little arpeggiated, you know, top stuff.
Yeah, but, it seems like. The pick, man. I don't think I could. Like, I don't play bass with a pick. I think that would.
Yeah.
I couldn't. No, I can't do it.
Yeah, I started playing bass with a pick. So the pick is no problem.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I don't think I could ever really fully. Like, I don't think I could, like, get out single note lines on the guitar without, like, staring at it and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's. My problem is there's like sort of a looseness with guitar playing that you kind of have to have, like, just, you know, you're muting some strings and you're kind of, you know, picking across the other strings to get to the note or something like that. And my guitar playing is very much like bass playing. It's almost too clean.
Okay. You know,
there's no guitar-ness to it.
Right. There's no grit to it.
Yeah. There's, I mean, it's hard for me to add that in, you know, like playing like a simple line or something like that. Single line is fine. And the bending too, that's the hardest thing. Like, seriously, bending a note and then, you know, in tune and then adding vibrato. Oh yeah. For the first, yeah. It took me about 10 years to figure out what vibrato meant on a guitar.
Right.
So I just hit a note and let it hang there and, you know, didn't know.
There's all that like guitar guy vocabulary that comes with the instrument.
Totally. Exactly.
Which I would like to say this publicly, and this will probably piss somebody off. Guitar players don't have it when they teach bass. And I can't stand when guitar players teach bass because they don't have it. There's a vocabulary in how you touch the instrument,
right.
Just like there is with guitar,
totally. But
there is with bass. And like, okay, the layout of the fretboard's the same. Cool. Function completely different. Like
exactly.
The technical vocabulary of it is completely different.
Yeah. And I mean, the way I approach it, I try to be as clean as I want every note that I play, you know, to be as pure and solid and the best tone as possible. So I'm really trying to be precise with whatever I do, even like in the knobs, which it's a total bar band. And, you know, we're just jamming half the time and, you know, whatever. But I mean, I'm still trying to play as cleanly as I can, you know, and if I flub some stuff, I don't worry. But like, yeah, it's a totally different approach when you play guitar because, yeah, like just all of that, the guitar stuff that you have to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I'm that interested in getting that deep with it. Like, you know, I'm still figuring it out on the bass. Like, I don't want to.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I don't want to throw another thing on there.
I hear you. Yeah. But there are guys that can, you know, play every instrument and they do it really well and they do it correctly.
They are. Yeah.
They're freaks.
Do you know the dude in town named Joel Whitley? Do you know Joel?
I don't.
He's one of those guys. Like I heard him. I didn't know who was on bass one night at a jam session. And I ran into a friend. I'm like, man, who is that? And they're like, that's Joel. I'm like, the guitar player? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, man, like he was crushing it as a bass player.
That's cool.
And I'm just like, dudes like that, it's cool because they get it. They respect it as right. an individual instrument and learn the instrument for the instrument's sake and don't try to use all their guitar stuff on bass or their bass stuff on guitar.
Right, right, exactly.
Those guys just make me feel like crap all the time.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, bass is hard enough.
It is.
Hard enough. It really is. I mean, especially for what I try to, not especially, but, you know, again, I try to be as exact as I can and as in the pocket as I can. And that's, I mean, like I'll practice 2 hours to just a drum machine, just putting it where I want to put it.
Right. You know,
that's fun for me. And that's enough for me. It's like, ah.
So talk about that process. That's interesting. Cause I have a thing of, like a little routine I use when practicing with a metronome. But how do you go about this? Do you play through a sequence you already know, so you're not thinking about what you're playing, and then nudge it around? Like this time I'm going to put it on top. This time I'm going to bury the click. This time I'm going to put it behind.
That's funny that you say that. Yeah. I was actually, what I do now, I mean, you know, it's evolved over 40 years of playing or whatever.
Yeah.
But what I do now is, you know, I'll pull up Digital Performer, and usually have like a drum beat, you know, program for each song that I'm playing, you know, and then I record a take of me playing the song, and I listen back and I'm like, okay, am I rushing stuff consistently? You know, am I, you know, lagging consistently? Is there like a, you know, a turnaround that I'm just not playing cleanly enough, you know?
Yeah.
And then I'll just kind of on my own kind of go over that turnaround or whatever. But it's funny. If I had had this stuff when I was a teenager, I would have just, you know, I would have just been hopeless. Cause I was playing some song and it was just like kind of an, I don't know, 8 bars of 8th notes. And I was listening and I'm like, oh, it sounds like am I rushing that a little bit? It wasn't feeling too good. And I looked at it and I was like, I was, you know, not exactly where I wanted it to be. So I'm like, okay, I want to play this, you know, these 8 bars, but I want to put it behind the beat, just a hair, just feel like it's just behind the beat, just a hair. And I played it. And then I zoomed in to the waveform and I'm looking at it. And I was like, holy cow, that's like, I mean, consistently just behind the beat, just behind the beat. I'm like, that's cool. And then I was like, well, let me see if I can put it, like bury it. I mean, right on it.
Right.
I did 8 bars of that and I'm looking at it and it was right on the beat. I'm like, well, that's cool.
Yeah.
So I would have gone crazy with that stuff back in my, you know, when I was a teenager or, you know,
obsessing over where it is consistently.
Exactly. Just being able to put it where you want it.
Yeah.
On call.
Right.
Is.
Right. And,
dude, Pino, I was thinking about this last night. Pino is, I mean, he must know that he's doing this, but he can play with whatever rhythm section he's playing with. There's an Aleta Adams album that her first album, I forget what it's called. And I don't know who the drummer was, but he's like he's like very on top of the beat.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't sound like Weckl, but it's kind of like that, you know, just everything a little on top, right on the beat, or maybe even a little on top. And Pino is right there with them. And then there was this Paul Rodgers Muddy Waters tribute album that Jason Bonham played on. And Jason is like painfully like behind the beat and heavy and, you know, just really fat. And Pino is right there with him.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
How good he is at just fitting in with, you know, a rhythm section.
Yeah. Yeah. I've read articles and stuff about him. And he, from what I gather from reading the articles, he really kind of prides himself, I guess, for lack of a better term, in reinventing himself almost in every musical situation.
Right.
So it's still him. Like, you listen to an 80s track with him on fretless, like, yep, that's Pino.
Yep.
Or you can listen to any neo soul thing from the early 2000s, like, yeah, that's exactly. Pino. Yep. But it's also so that thing. You know, like, it's so much of, like, it's definitely neo soul. It's definitely 80s pop rock. Yep. But it's all still Pino, and it's almost like he's an actor or something. Like, he's the way he conceives of it, I would love to talk to him about.
Yeah, yeah. He's amazing. He's so good. And yeah. And that's what the kind of fitting in with rhythm sections, that's what I've always tried to do. I always just try to slot in wherever the drummer is. It's like, I'm going to be right there with the drummer, hopefully, you know?
Right. Now, okay. What do you do when you don't agree? When you think the drummer is, like, let's say, playing on top, and it's a musical situation, like a shuffly blues or something, like kind of a swampy thing when it should be behind. And you're like, oh man, I don't personally agree with your decision.
Yeah.
What do you do in that scenario?
You kind of have to go with the drummer. Otherwise, yeah. I mean, I'll try to cheat on, like, if the drummer's rushing, I'll try to cheat a little bit behind the beat.
Split the difference, kind of.
Well, not by a lot, you know.
Right.
But yeah, I try to like trying to play behind the beat on the eighth notes or whatever. I try to put it there and hopefully, you know, things will come back a little bit tempo wise, but I don't know. You just kind of, you're kind of at the mercy of the drummer, I feel. Cause if you're not tight with the drummer, it's, you know, you gotta make the fact that it's too fast work or that's too slow work.
Sure. You know? Right.
And kind of fighting it, I think.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. Like, you have to definitely still make, if that's what's happening in the music, if the drummer's on top or anybody is on top, you know, if the singer's rushing, you know, well, that means, like, the whole thing now has this kind of manic nature to it, you know, like, well, now what am I going to do with that? Because you have to somehow support it still.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah. If the singer's rushing it, then the band sounds like it's behind.
Yeah.
You know, even if you're where you're supposed to be.
Right.
Yeah, so then you
and have the tendency is to, like, follow them, and if they're used to hearing it on top, then the thing's a runaway train.
Right.
Because they're just going to stay on top and keep pulling the band faster.
Well, you know, I mean, I've spent so long trying to be, you know, like I said, perfect and trying to keep the groove consistent and all that kind of stuff. I mean, with the knobs, it can go any kind of way, you know, and you just, the crowd loves it. I've learned to go with it and to not judge myself, like, oh, you know, it should be consistent, but the fact that it's breathing and you know, moving around, and but as long as it has attitude and stuff like that, it's working. I do have to not judge myself, and I don't. I mean, I'm like, you know, because I know I'm not the one that is, you know, speeding it up, you know, in the chorus or whatever. You know, it's probably better that the tune is moving around like that than if I'm like, no, we got to keep it right here. And, you know,
yeah,
I don't know.
I mean, do you regularly go there in your head during live performances when tempos get pushed and pulled?
Oh yeah,
Things aren't so systematic.
Yeah, I'm really bad at that. I mean, I'm constantly, you know, monitoring myself.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, yeah, what am I doing? Am I playing okay? Am I not? You know, and it's not so much that, you know, I used to be really hard on myself. Like, if I made a mistake, like, that was the worst thing that could possibly happen. You know, mm-hmm. I would just make sure that I never made a mistake, as impossible as that is.
Sure.
I don't think I make enough mistakes these days that it affects a song, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure.
Now, when you say mistake, to what degree are we talking? Are we talking about, like, there was one 16th note that was a little bit too long like the nature of feel? Hit the A string and you meant to hit the D string.
Exactly. It used to be, I swear to God, like when I was touring with Henley, especially early on, it was a mistake was, okay, that eighth note in the second bar of that verse was just too lagged, you know? And Yeah, I mean, I used to be like that, but now, no, it's like, okay, instead of, yeah, going to the D, I hit a G. It's like, yeah. All right, whatever. I wasn't paying attention. But no, yeah, I wish, I've had this thought actually recently, and, you know, I wish that I could be as loose and sort of non-judgmental of my playing when I'm rehearsing live. And I don't, okay. I don't know why I can't do that.
Really? Like, the switch kind of gets flipped internally.
Yeah. It's like, I'm okay. Now this is for real. I don't know if it's that, now it's for real or what it is, but it would be it's like, maybe it's like the live version equivalent of red light
syndrome. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's not like I'm not freaked out about it.
Right.
But there's just that monitor that switches on. It's like, okay, now you have to make sure that you play it correctly.
Yeah.
That in rehearsal, I don't worry about it. Cause I know the song, I know I'm going to play it well. And it's almost like in rehearsal, it doesn't matter because no one's hearing it.
Yeah.
But
there's kind of no accountability.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I probably play exactly the same in rehearsal that I do live. But there's just that, you know, that extra freedom, inspiration that pops up because I'm just, you know, I'm not stressed out. I'm not like really monitoring myself like when we do a live show.
So is there a time in the live show where you can kind of maybe halfway through or towards the end when you've been in the show for, you know, the majority of the set where you can finally let go and just like be in the music?
You know, it's funny, like that reminds me, like back in the Henley days, I would be like really nervous up until I heard somebody else in the band miss one small note.
Okay. Then you had an allowance. Then
exactly. I wasn't the first
guy. They gave you permission. Yeah.
Totally. Then it's like, okay. but no, I mean, I mean, even the last song of the show or whatever, I'm like, okay, you know, how are you playing this? You know, just this little, you know, voice in the back of my head is always kind of, so I never get, I mean, if I'm doing a cover gig, you know, at a bar or something like that, I mean, that's a whole different thing. That's like a rehearsal.
Yeah.
It's like, we're all having fun and we're entertaining the people. And I should have that exact same mindset when I'm playing with the Knobs, but for some reason, like, you know, playing with the Knobs or playing with whoever, you know, like an actual, you know, real artist.
Yeah.
At what I think is a real show. Yeah. I just get a little, just enough that I notice it. And yeah. I wish that I didn't have that.
So then when you're in the studio composing, is there just like this kind of weight that's off your shoulders because it's just you sitting there in the studio and you can go over it 1,000 times and everything can be so yeah. Systematically precise.
Exactly. And or not even, it doesn't even need to be precise. Like I do try to, when I'm putting a track together, I'm not trying to make it perfect. I'm trying to make it feel good.
Okay. You know?
And if I'm a little off or if I do something that's not perfect, but it feels good, I'm like, cool, man, that's good enough. And that was also like when I did a bunch of sessions, I mean, I never got, you know, red light fever because I think I knew that it's like, if I made a mistake, we can always punch in.
Yeah.
You know, but, but I definitely don't, because you're recording and you can always, you know, fix something or punch in or whatever. I don't have as much of a, okay, we've got to get this perfect.
Right. Live. There's no do-overs.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I should talk, and I see so many musicians that look like those guys just look like they're just having fun and they're not judging or stressed out at all about their playing. I'm like, how do you do that? I mean, Mike is one of those guys, and that's why he's a, you know, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, and he's as right. successful as he is.
Have you talked to him about it?
Not really.
No.
Really. I mean another part of that is also, you know, he actually is and he's done it for so long, but he's a really good showman, you know, yeah. And he just, he can get up there and inspire people. And I don't consider myself a showman at all.
Yeah.
Like I play music.
Right.
And I can only kind of be myself on stage.
Yeah.
And that's probably boring in a lot of ways. But I only laugh
because I'm convinced I'm the same way.
But like, for instance, I swear to God, why am I looking around? Like,
I don't know. It's your house too. Who's going to show up?
Right. Exactly. No, but like the whole thing of getting the crowd to clap their hands, I can't do it.
Sure.
I won't do it.
Yeah.
Like I'll let everybody else in the band do it. Cause I just, for whatever reason, it's like, that says to me, I don't know. It just doesn't seem to be authentic. It's not what I want to do.
Right.
So I feel like I'm just being an actor or something. Sure. I mean, that's what being a showman is, you know,
I think it's in their blood that they're entertainers.
Right.
And they have to get people engaged, and it's on a core level with these people. Like they need it for their personal validation to get everybody involved and hyped up and excited. Like they're excited. I don't have it. I don't even think I'm moderately inspirational. Like if you like it, you like it. Like I'm not going to try to coax you into clapping your hands. If you want to clap them, but you know,
exactly.
Do whatever you feel like. I don't care.
I kind of feel the same way. And I was talking to Mike about that actually, because he was talking about how he loves playing in front of an audience and you know, feeling the connection and feeling the energy off of the crowd. And I don't feed off the energy of the crowd. I feed off the energy of the band.
Same, yeah.
But I think a part of that is the Knobs are a different thing. I mean, I was always, anytime I did a big tour or something like that, the crowd is cheering, you know, Don Henley or Rod Stewart or whoever. They're not cheering me. Right?
Yeah.
So it's like, Mike is up there with his band playing his songs.
Yeah. And
so he's, you know, the energy is directed towards him.
Right.
So I think that's a big part of why I never, like, that I was just never in a position. And
sure.
And now it's a little different because, you know, I am a member of the Knobs, but it's still all about Mike. You know? I mean, I don't take any credit at all for, you know, anybody showing up. They're showing up to see, you know, Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And I mean, and Mike's, you know, they're listening to his songs and stuff like that. I mean, I have kind of, you know, my own ownership of like the bass chair, but yeah, that's still not enough for me to feel like the crowd is, you know, losing their shit over my bass part.
Right.
So,
I mean, I think to go back to Pino, a friend of mine went to go see Mayer at the Forum. Like, I don't know when that was, not that long ago, a few months ago. And I get a text that, like, you know, the crowd erupted when they introduced Pino. And sure. Pino's got this like kind of the resurgence of fame, not only among bass players and musicians, but like now towards normal people because of Mayer. Maybe it's because of Mayer. I don't know. Like, you know, I mean, we're a bass player, so he's always been a big deal to us.
Sure.
Yeah. But it seems like now everybody else is hip to him too. So, I mean, I that would probably feel amazing if you're, you know, on stage at the Forum and they introduce your name and the crowd erupts and you get a standing ovation. Like, okay,
right
now I could understand what the front man.
Right.
I can understand it. I don't think I have the charisma to now know what to do with that. You know, like, I don't know. All right. Cool. Now and what? I got nothing.
I would also like we're going to be opening for The Who at the Hollywood Bowl, which.
That's huge. I want to go, man.
Absolutely. November 1st. And it's just the Knobs and The Who. So it's just going to be so much fun. But I'm just imagining, you know, Mike introducing me at the Hollywood Bowl and everybody going, and I would just be like, well, they're being polite. You know, they're
you clapping. Explain it away.
They're clapping because they appreciate it, but they don't know who I am or you know, anything like that.
Right. No, maybe everybody does. I have the same thing of like, you know, you're leaving a gig and they see you with your bass on your back, like, oh, the music was great tonight. You sounded amazing. You wouldn't recognize me if I didn't have a bass on right now.
Oh, right.
You know, like, whatever. That's just something you're saying because you realize I'm a musician. Other than that, you wouldn't recognize me at all.
Right. Right. You know? I mean, yeah.
No,
yeah.
I explain things away like that in my head all the time.
Yeah, I don't. I used to be a lot harsher on myself, I guess. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I used to not be able to take a compliment. Like if somebody, you know, said, "Hey, man, you did great tonight." I mean, I'm talking like, you know, when I was, you know, late teens and early 20s and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I'd be like, dude, you sounded great. And I'd be like, no, I sucked.
Yeah.
because I felt I'm being honest because I felt like I sucked. Right.
Yeah.
But it, you know, it took me a while to realize. And once I did realize, when I say I suck, it's not that I'm being honest. I'm telling this person they don't know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's kind of an insult to them.
Sure.
So I got to this point where I would at least politely acknowledge it. Like, oh, thank you very much.
Right.
Even if I thought that I sucked.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, great.
Thanks for the compliment.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I still, you know, the only thing that matters to me still is if I think I did a good job or if I didn't do a good job. So if I feel like I had a good gig and no one says I did a good gig, I'm like, that's fine.
Yeah.
Because I do think a big part of what I do, if I'm doing my job right in certain gigs and stuff like that, is kind of just being supportive mm-hmm. and not sticking out.
Yeah.
And not having people notice me and stuff like that, but just being solid.
Yeah.
But if I felt like, I mean, I could not have been more solid. I did my job the best that I could and damn, I did it well. You know, and if nobody says anything, I'm fine.
Yeah.
The same way, if I feel like I had a really bad gig, and people are like, oh man, you sounded great. I'm like, thank you. You know, it doesn't make me feel
right. But did you hear the 1/8 note at the last half of the verse too?
I've gotten so much better with that. I've let all of that stuff go. But it's
what was
more,
the process to do that? What was the process you went through? However long it took, what was the process to kind of shed some of that self negative talk?
I think part of it is, you know, your friends and some of the people that you work with, you feel like they honestly do appreciate, you know, what you're bringing to the party and your skills and stuff like that. And they're more forgiving, or probably they don't even hear what I'm hearing.
Sure.
So it's like,
I mean, honestly, every musician is probably to a little bit thinking how you're thinking about you, you know, and like this self analytical thing. They're thinking about that about themselves.
Sure. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Like you're not in the forefront of their mind. You know, they're thinking like, oh man, am I gonna hit this thing how I want to?
Right.
You know, and so like they probably don't even think about us.
Right. Well, I think in general, I've had a conversation with some friends recently about this, you know, who just in general, just in life, they're like, oh, man, that guy hates me, or, you know, that guy's doesn't whatever is thinking bad thoughts about me. And I'm like, dude, most of the time, they're not even thinking about you at all.
No,
you know, just in general, you know, everybody's just kind of, you know, doing their own thing.
I definitely believe that the majority of people, the majority of the time, are only responding to themselves within how they relate to other people.
Sure.
They're only, you know, if they like something somebody is doing, that's probably because they wish they were doing it.
Right. You know? Or that's just they do like it. It's just their taste or whatever. But
yeah
the beyond.
But I think it's all coming from kind of this place of like, if it was them, you know, over there on the other side of the compliment or something.
Oh, uh-huh.
You know, people in the crowd maybe wish that they were on stage so that they're going to love the music. Everybody's responding to themselves and how they think about. Versus, I guess to say that a lot cleaner, I don't think they're ever really truly objective.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's all kind of a little bit of projection involved all the time with everything.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And again, I you know, I think in general, like a person tends to think that there's more focus on them from people at any one time than there actually is.
Yeah, 100%. Like, right.
They don't care that you made a mistake. They're not even paying attention.
No,
they're
not at all
there or whatever.
Right. You know? Or if the mistake happened in the bass chair, how does that affect them? That's.
It probably didn't even register. It's like, okay, mistake, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, you know, whatever. Unless it's like some kind of, you know, like the Van Halen what was it? Jump thing where the keyboard goes out of tune. You know, there's some.
What's that?
Oh yeah. Something happened, like the keyboard got detuned or something like that. So it was a train wreck and like Eddie couldn't hear that it was out of tune, but I guess because of whatever the monitor situation was, you know,
right. But
yeah, it was just bad.
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know about
that. Like this, who knows, was this 10, 15 years ago or something right. like that. It's probably on YouTube if you want to look at it.
It probably is. Everything is. People didn't even have like the technology to record back then, but everything's on YouTube. You know, how did they record it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like, were we always being secretly filmed?
Right.
In hopes that YouTube would exist someday?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I don't know. I don't. Yeah, there's a bunch of footage of a bunch of old stuff that I sometimes wonder how it got there. Mm-hmm. So what else has been going on? You've been touring with the Knobs? You've been doing any sessions on bass?
Not a whole lot. A couple of things from like a songwriter or, you know, somebody that's putting some tracks together for like a TV show or something like that. But I've just been so busy and so focused on the Knobs. I feel like, you know, this is the first kind of band that I've been in,
mm-hmm.
you know, that is now tour. Well, I mean, I was in Volto, and Volto, we were signed. That was like, you know, instrumental band with Danny Carey.
And okay.
So, but we did like one tiny little tour and stuff like that. And it was just, you know, we were all so busy that we never made it like a real push to be a band. And this is kind of like the first time that I've been in like a real band. And so I'm just kind of focusing on that and not worrying about other stuff.
Okay. Okay. Now within the band, so it's a band.
Yeah.
You're like a made guy in the band. Like you're totally, in.
Yeah. 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 We're supposedly, yeah. We're, you know, sharing in profits and stuff like that.
Okay. Now does everybody have kind of specific roles within the band? Not only like, I mean, this isn't any kind of grassroots situation where some guy's handling tour support and the other guy's handling merch. It's not like that. But within a band of this caliber and at this level, do you guys all have the duties within the project to keep it happening? Or is that all sussed out to when it comes to, you know, making calls to line up a tour manager or, you know, someone connecting with the PR company?
Right.
Or, you know, stuff like that. Do you guys have segregated responsibilities like that?
Well, in the band, I mean, it's kind of like a pro band in that, I mean, we're signed to BMG and we have management. And so we have, you know, everybody taking care of that.
Sure.
Within the band itself, like musically, like, I mean, Mike's definitely the leader and he's, you know, writing all the stuff and bringing it to us. But at that point, you know, when he brings us a song, we kind of, you know, we jam it, we play what we want on it. And, you know, unless Mike has a specific, you know, idea for a bass part, a drum beat or something like that, you know, we kind of do what we want to do.
Yeah. Okay. So there's still a lot of freedom musically. And even like there's not a lot of heavy responsibilities to keep the machine moving. Like,
no, not at all.
All that stuff. That's great.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it's like the first like real band that I've been in. Yeah, nobody's, you know, trying to hustle a gig somewhere or, you know, trying to do promo. Like that's all taken care of.
Right. Now, within being in a band, how far do you push yourself to find it, like investigate new sounds? Like, all right, this time I'm going to, you know, I really want to check out this pedal or something, this effect. And next time he brings a tune in, I want to see what I can get away with and push myself as a bass player to investigate new sounds or techniques. Or since you have all this freedom within the band, do you take advantage of that?
Yes and no. I mean, I feel like there's definitely sort of a sound of the band.
Okay.
You know, and for me, it's like, I think the main sound is a P bass with flats and a picker fingers, you know? So
that's kind of the sound all the time. Like there's few exceptions to that rule.
Yeah, but it's a rock band, you know. I mean, I guess I could have, you know, because growing up, my first bass was a Rick and I played with a pick, and Chris Squire and Getty were my guys.
Yeah, okay.
Like high school and even college. So I was just that guy that had that grindy, you know, Rick tone,
mm-hmm.
right? And So, I mean, I could go, but I just don't think that's like the sound of this band.
Right.
You know, like, again, it's more just the kind of the thumpy, you know, P bass with flats and a pick. But Mike loves distorted bass. So he'll like, even if I don't like track it with distortion, he'll like tell the engineer, hey, throw like a distortion plugin on it.
Okay.
You know, so a lot of stuff is a little more overdriven and,
what do you like? Do you go to a hard overdrive surround, or you just put a little hair on it for some texture?
Well, like when we were doing the album, I had nothing to do with it. Like the engineer just threw on whatever, you know, Mike wanted to hear.
Okay.
I've got a, what is it? A Lucy Screamer from Jam Pedals.
Oh, I've never even heard of
like,
it.
It's like a tube screamer, but it's also got another side that you can kick in that kind of kicks it into fuzz.
Okay.
So like I'll use sort of just the one side that's a little more tube screamery on a couple of tracks on just the bass tone. So the bass tone's like really overdriven, but still not like crazy.
Yeah.
And then there are a couple of solos Mike wants me, you know, asks me to do. And then I kick in the other one and it's just, you know, full on crazy fuzz and stuff. Nice. Like that. So yeah. And then it just gets crazy.
Yeah.
That's a whole other, the whole bass solo thing is just so funny. I mean, because I never worked at soloing that, like, I just, sure. it never, I mean, I enjoy like little fills or whatever. And, but like an entire, but like a bass solo where it's like, here you go, you know, you got 5 minutes to do whatever you want to do. Like, I just never worked up a vocabulary.
Right.
That wasn't what I wanted to do. But so it like,
so where do you go then? Where do you, when this happens, like nightly, is there always like a moment of panic where you're like, here it comes. Now we're playing that tune. I'm going to have solo. Where do I start?
Yeah, it's not panic though, but it's also, I don't know what it is. Every night it's a little different. I surrender to the fact that I have zero vocabulary, but I kind of make stuff up. I kick in the fuzz.
Okay.
And then it's just like, okay, what do you feel like playing?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to teach anybody any new great licks or any solo, but I figure that's the one part where it's like, I am a performer and I have to put on my big boy performer, you know, pants and just kind of step up. And, you know, I mean, I tend to, a lot of times I will, I'll use humor to kind of deflect and to make something, just like, okay, I'm just using humor here just to let everybody know that I know that I'm not the greatest.
Kind of a self-aware thing.
I really do try not to do that because but I'm sure a little bit of that, you know, creeps out too. I mean, I'll do a couple of times I'm doing this really over, you know, this fuzzy solo, you know, at this one point in the show. And then my solo becomes, I'm just detuning or tuning, and that's how I'm playing. You know, so it's just like doing this crazy goofiness, kind of goofy, but I'm kind of taking it seriously, and it's kind of a thing. And then you just totally dive bomb it, and it just it's a thing. And
sure. You know,
crowds love it, but yeah, bass solos are, I'm just not that guy. But I make the most. I try to be entertaining. I should actually sit down and be like, okay, what should I play? Shouldn't I like figure out some licks or something? And
it seems like what you just described with the tuning, detuning, that's more in the moment. That's
right.
That's better than it being scripted. It's like, okay, here's my little, walk to the front of the stage and play this little scripted thing and then go back there. Like, it's more entertaining. And I feel like it communicates to the crowd when there's a rawness to it all.
Totally.
Regardless of what it is.
You know, like I said, I mean, I'm playing with the pick, so a lot of times I'll just do the, you know, I'm trilling higher, higher, higher with all this distortion.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I'm feeling like. And there's no lick involved. It's just, you know,
just sound
noise and energy kind of.
Yeah. I think that's all people care about really is
exactly
the energy. No one, even if you worked out like some really, you know, vocabulary based thing, no one's going to know.
Right.
You know, there's nobody's. No one's going to be like, oh, yeah, I have that Anthony Jackson album, too. I know where you got that lick. Like, no one's going to
No one's going to call you out or probably even understand. They just want the energy and to be entertained. They're like, oh, but now bass guy's doing a thing. Okay, right. Now let's go back to Mike.
Right. And also, I mean, part of it, there's a whole visual to it. And it's totally Mike's idea. But like he and Jason Sine, the other guitar player, playing white Firebirds.
Okay.
And I've got like a white Thunderbird.
Oh,
and
nice.
So, yeah. So we just got like these white similar guitars and they make a whole thing of it. And
that's cool.
Yeah.
Is that the P bass right there that you're talking about? The one right behind you?
No, that's my 64.
Oh, nice. All original?
Yes. And it has the best neck on it of any neck
ever
played. It's so good. It's so good. Yeah, I love it. It's my baby. We're the same age.
Yeah. How'd you come across that?
Went to Norm's. And
I remember hearing of Norm's. Is it still around in the Valley, right?
Totally. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, so that was the first vintage instrument I got for the longest time. And this was even...
Like Vineland and Ventura?
It's Ventura and sort of, it's in Encino, I guess.
Okay. I'm thinking of a different vintage shop.
Yeah. For the longest time, I had zero desire to get a vintage instrument because from my experience, you know, I would go in and do sessions and get a tone that I thought was amazing, you know? And then after the mixer and the mastering guy got done with it, like I didn't even recognize the tone.
Right.
I'm like, so why should I get a vintage instrument? And
it has all this character to the sound and then they just wash it out and it could be a Squire with flats.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what happened. One track I had my Rick and I did the Rico sound thing. I had like, you know, the treble pickup going to an SVT and the bass pickup.
Oh, wow.
Going into the board. And it was, dude, I'm telling you, when we were tracking, I was like, oh my God, I'm Chris Squire. And I was doing all this crazy. It was so much fun. And I was so excited. I could not wait. It was a big artist. I could not wait for it to come out and everybody to go, whoa, who's that guy?
Yeah.
And it comes out and the mixer had just used the bass pickup.
Right.
It was just like, and it like added all sorts, it just subbed to it.
Right.
It was just this rumble. I was like, what the hell? So anyway, I was like, you know what? You know, I've got instruments that can get 90% of the tone that a vintage instrument could get or whatever. And it's not going to matter anyway. So long story, even longer. So I went to Norm's one time and I'm like, maybe I should look at vintage instruments. And I tried out all the P basses that he had, and this was there. And I was like, oh my God. So a vintage instrument is not for the mixing engineer or the mastering guy or that. It's for me.
Yeah.
I was like, this bass is the most awesome bass ever.
Right. To inspire you to play.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So that's when that was the first like vintage instrument that I got.
Okay. Now to circle back to what you were just talking about how they, you know, wiped out your sound on this record. As someone who composes and produces, when you are dealing with a mix, do you do mixing at all?
Yeah. Okay. I usually mix and master my own stuff.
When you're doing a mix, what do you give to the sub territory in a mix? Do you put the kick drum down there and the bass on top, or do you put the drums on top of the bass? Because that's always a thing in mix. Sometimes they just assign all the sub frequencies to the bass and then make the bass as round as they possibly can, so that everything sits on top of it. And then other times they put the drums down there and the bass can have a little bit more character on top.
Right.
In the mix. So how do you treat it? Do you mix it like tune by tune or project by project?
It's definitely project by project. And hopefully there's some kind of reference or it's like, hey, we want to do something like we just did like some 70s stuff, like 70s AM radio, like, you know, Bread and Seals and Crofts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so going back, listening to some of that stuff, like it's hilarious. Like this one Bread track that I was like, okay, I'll kind of reference this. I mean, the tune had nothing to do with it, but it's like, I'll mix it like that and sort of arrange it like that. And like the bass is, you know, panned to one side.
Right.
And it, you know, just craziness like that.
Yeah. But, I feel like mixes were the wild, wild west back in, the early 70s and stuff. It was kind of just like record and get it out.
Exactly. Yeah. And also back then, I was thinking about this too. Why was I thinking about this? But like, That's why. Like a lot of the bass lines back then, you know, in the 70s and 60s, you know, the bass player's playing a lot of stuff, you know, kind of high up on the fretboard. It's not all just, you know, low, you know, E string stuff and, and A string stuff. And I'm sure it's because not that they couldn't record low end back then, but they just didn't mix any low end into it. You know, just the playback, your AM radio would never hear it. The you know, the home hi-fi systems of the day really couldn't reproduce it.
Yeah.
They never mixed it with
any of that. Thought about that.
So, so you can play up high. You need to kind of play up high to kind of poke out.
Yeah.
And these days, because especially with digital, you know, you don't have to worry about putting too much bass in a record grooves and having the, you know, the needle bouncing all around.
Right.
You can just throw as much low end as you want on it. So everybody, you know, the thing to do is to play down low. And, you know, a lot of tunes in the knobs, I intentionally kind of play it an octave up of where I, like a normal modern guy would play it.
Okay.
Just because it's like, you know what? I mean, that's the way they used to do it.
And yeah.
I mean, why not? I don't want it. Everything doesn't have to have the biggest, fattest, most modern.
No, you know, by the time the audience gets it, it's going through, you know, a tower of subs, you know, with the crossover and all that stuff. Oh, so they're getting all their due amount of low end, you know,
but it's
regardless of what octave you play in.
Yeah, it's fun playing up, you know, an octave.
Yeah.
Because that's, again, like a lot of, you know, McCartney used to do a lot of stuff up there. Yeah. A lot of those guys back in the 60s, especially, would play it up there.
Yeah. I never thought about that as it would relate to the mix. So what kind of, do you like writing things from that time period? Like when you are composing?
Oh yeah. Yeah, totally.
Is that one of your favorite time periods to kind of replicate or to pull from?
Sure. I mean, it's a little more, probably my favorite time period is whatever's the easiest. And usually, but for me, that means like indie rock stuff usually.
Yeah.
Like eighth notey and maybe a little quirky and stuff like that. And doesn't have to be too exacting. I mean, that was the challenge of the 70s stuff is like, you know, you had real studio musicians back then, you know, you had the Wrecking Crew and, you know, so it's like, okay, I've got to come up with a part that sounds like it was played by like a real guitar player and stuff like that. So that was the challenge there. But still it's fun. I mean, there were so many great songs back then, you know?
There was. Yeah.
So it's nice to, it's like, okay, the challenge is to, you know, write a good song. A funny side note to that is there was a song that I wrote in college and musically it's okay, but lyrically it's just the most collegey, precocious thing is the way I'll put it. But I was like,
hear it.
I'll send you a copy of it. Yeah. And it's the one that I kind of bredified.
Okay.
So it was like a song that I wrote in college, very sensitive, precocious college guy. So that became a library classic now.
Nice.
So yeah.
Nice.
I think the most fun thing for me doing, especially like these kind of the library stuff, which is usually like vocal oriented. And there's usually like a concept like 70s AM radio or, you know, 80s rock or, you know, 90s indie or whatever, or even like modern stuff. Like, you know, we'll get some band references like, yeah, write something in style of this. And it's just, discovered so many cool bands that I never would have heard.
Okay.
And I'm like, oh, that's actually really cool.
Yeah.
And then listening how, you know, that band, how their production is and, you know, whoever produced that and just, you know, it's really nice to kind of just get in the weeds on a bunch of different types of songs and music.
Do you find yourself when playing with an artist or a band in this scenario with the Dirty Knobs, pulling from what you've learned? So like, if you're going to try to duplicate a vocabulary of the 70s for something you're writing or producing, now when you're playing with the knobs, this is like, okay, I'm going to go a little bit more 70s on this one. I'm going to play, you know, my eighth notes like Stingwood with the Police on this one. And you're just pulling from all these influences tune by tune throughout the set.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that goes like I said, playing, you know, higher up an octave up
sure.
is kind of, you know, an example of that.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
but,
I think that's an underrated thing, actually.
But also, I mean, I think in general, you know, Mike, and he says that all the time, like this, his thing is like 60s rock. That's like his favorite time period. Yeah. And he's always going to kind of play in that style. And so I feel like I mean, I've been meaning to, I should shed more 60s stuff just to get more in that zone.
60s rock stuff. Like,
yeah, yeah.
The Stones and, you know, the Beatles. And I mean, there's all that stuff. I'm trying to think of like when I think of 60s, I always think of like British bands when it comes to rock.
Right.
And then like soul stuff when it comes to America.
Right. But like Birds, maybe, you know, that's you know, and Crosby, Stills and Nash and like just all kinds of like early stuff.
Yeah.
Just to kind of see what the approach was. I mean, the Beatles, I did this thing. I mean, I kind of came late to the Beatles. I always liked the Beatles, but I had friends in high school that were like, you know, they were maniacs about it.
Yeah.
And I was always like,
kind of turned me off. Like the Beatles cult turned me off to it a little bit.
For me, I was kind of snobby. This, you know, this would have been like late 70s, early 80s. You know, I was like just like audio snob, I guess. It's like the Beatles, that stuff sounds old. You know, like, you know, let's listen to Kansas, man, you know, like Kansas, you know, or Boston. Listen to how a Boston record sounds.
Yeah.
The Beatles sound anyway. But again, I always liked the tunes and I always liked, you know, the songs where they'd come on. But I had this, I literally had a like a born again Beatles moment, like in my early 30s. Just one day I was like, oh, my God, I get it. Mm-hmm. I get it. It's not even close that they're the best band.
What record?
It was no record. It was just one day. just one day I just realized, and I don't know exactly why, but it hit me. You know, it's like the cult, you know, the Beatles were always around me. I mean, how can they not be?
Sure.
And I was like, yeah, 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 yeah. And then just one day I was like, oh my God, I get it. And one of the things that I ended up doing, there was this book. I think the guy's name is Mark Levison. That's called like the Beatles, the complete recordings, where he documents like every single day that the Beatles went into a recording studio.
Oh, wow. And
what they recorded that day.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, 64, April 64, they did this and blah, blah, blah. And then they did the album version of this song. So okay. You're like, oh, they did that. Anyway, he talked about all these different versions of all these songs that, you know, that were great, but you never heard them because they were just, you know, they didn't use that version. Mm. And then they released these CD set called Anthology, I think. Beatles Anthology.
Like, yeah, like what? I was that right around the time that documentary came out in like the late 90s or mid 90s?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I remember that.
And so I bought the Anthology, and in those CDs were a lot of the versions of the songs that were talked about in the book. So I could finally hear them.
Yeah.
So I got this idea. I'm like, okay, I am such a freak. I went from the beginning of the book and I'm like, I'm going to go like chronologically.
Yeah. And check them out. Like, all the everything
in order. It's like, yeah. Okay, on this day they did Love Me Do, this version. And it's like, okay, it's on the Anthology. Yeah. So I would learn the bass part.
Oh, wow.
And then the next day they did the album version of Love Me Do. It's like, okay, well, let me learn that.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to go on this Paul McCartney journey.
Okay.
And just, you know, just go literally day by day and watch and see if I could figure out how his playing progressed. Because, you know, in the early days, there's a lot of 1-in-5 stuff or just kind of the walking bass.
Yeah. I mean, the early stuff, he's just duplicating the left hand of a boogie woogie piano part. Yeah.
And then he, you know, he's doing, you know, Dear Prudence and he's doing something. It's like, what?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you get there?
Mm-hmm.
So I think I got through Rubber Soul.
Okay.
Before I was just like, I got plenty of other stuff to do. I got to
I gotta check back into life.
Exactly right. Exactly right. But, but yeah, so I mean, Paul McCartney is he's got to be my favorite bass player. Just because what he does, the way he supports the song melodically and how creative he gets and just his whole approach. Yeah,
Now, because he's a multi-instrumentalist and a songwriter, and he's coming from a, as a bass player, he's got all this other approach to the song, right? Because he might have written it. He's probably singing it, something. So he's thinking about the bass, not from a bass player mentality.
He started off on guitar, right? And they
I don't know that much about it.
I think he started off on guitar and they switched over to bass. It's like, okay, we need a bass player now.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay. But yeah, he still plays bass like a bass player.
He does. He does. There's definitely like a part within. Now, I have not studied him to the degree you have.
You should do it. Start from the beginning. Every get the anthology CDs and all the albums.
Yeah. There's noticeable shifts in his playing for sure. That, I mean, obviously there's noticeable shifts in the Beatles where they're just kind of mimicking, you know, the soul music that's in America, but they're doing it as Brits.
Right.
Okay. And then they really finally kind of find their own sound, you know, where it gets out of this just duplication process.
Right.
And then they find their own sound. And I think it wasn't too far after that that you can really hear McCartney start to develop his thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like kind of focus on the bass playing in a new way. And he wasn't just doing a left hand boogie woogie pattern or a 1-5 thing or just holding down, you know, roots. He was kind of coming up with lines that were a little bit more unique.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. And I mean, the Beatles, the thing that still blows me away about them is, I mean, they just kept evolving and trying something new. Mm-hmm. And everything new that they tried was awesome. It wasn't like they tried something new just to try it and it was just, let's try something weird. I mean, everything they tried and everything they wrote is just so great. And they you know, their last album was freaking Abbey Road.
Right. You know?
And it's like, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, it is. It's funny because there's an element, and I think this happens in anything within the world. You get to a certain level of celebrity that you'll always continue to be a celebrity. You know, I don't think the Beatles could have ever tanked because they were already the Beatles. Everybody was just drinking the Kool-Aid. You know, I like this. People are just like, I love the Beatles. So whatever the Beatles put out, I'm going to find amazing. If I love a stand-up comic, I'm going to think everything he or she says is hilarious because at some point I connected with them, you know, 5 years ago and thought they were hilarious. Now in my mind, they're always hilarious no matter what. There's something about that audience member mentality. They're like, once you're in, you just kind of give yourself over to them.
Right.
In a way. I mean, I know I have. There's people I follow their career. It's like, yeah, you know, whatever they put out, I'm probably going to love. And I try to, this is something I work on. I try to continue to train myself to be completely objective about what I'm listening to all the time, regardless of who it is.
Right.
So it's like, man, I loved that record. This one, no, that, I don't know what happened there. That record sucked.
Right.
But it's the same guy. That's something I work on. I want to stay completely objective and appreciate the art for what the art is.
Right. I don't know. Maybe I do that. I don't think I'm doing that with the Beatles. I
didn't want to accuse you of that, but me thinking. Yeah.
No, that's good. Sure. But I was also, I'm like, okay, what do I have any other examples? Like Rush is a good example of, I mean, after Moving Pictures, they lost me. Like I was, my two favorite bands were Yes and Rush.
Right.
Like, and so I'm like, woohoo. And, and then Signals comes out and I'm like, which was the Rush album after Moving Pictures. And I'm like, yeah, maybe there's some stuff. I mean, I was still kind of, I was like, yeah, Rush, new Rush album. Woo. And, you know, so I was still kind of excited, you know, trying to be excited, but definitely there's some headwinds at that point. I'm like, you know?
Yeah. I have that kind of thing with like some jazz guys. Like there's some stuff Miles did later in his career or Coltrane. That's like, yeah, that stuff's not for me. But I always ask myself, what is it about me that's not identifying with that in the same way? Am I keeping them? You know, let's say I loved the Coltrane 60s quartet. But then when he went off to go do this really, you know, avant-garde thing, is that only because I like him for how I kind of got introduced to him? And does that mean I really liked it for what it is? Or I just thought I should like it? Like, I second guess my own motives when it comes to how I react to art all the time.
I
heard the 60s quartet first, so now that's who Coltrane is to me. If he goes on and does this other thing, well, it's not that, but I loved this. Well, did you love that for that? Or did you love that because, you know, you thought you should love Coltrane and that's just what Coltrane was doing then? That's where my mind goes.
No, I like it. And I think about this a lot in this way, like what I like.
Yeah.
And I am 100% okay with that.
Okay.
And 100% protective of it, I guess. And I don't question it at all.
Mm.
And I don't wonder, I don't care if it's cool or not. Like, yeah. I'm sure I love all kinds of music that's not cool.
Right.
I'm sure there's cool music that I cannot stand.
Sure.
I remember like one guy, whatever, I saw some comment somewhere. And it's like, yeah, man, I love this music because it's so cool. And it just, I'm like, that's how, no.
Right. You
if you love music because it's cool, you don't love music. You love cool things.
Right, right. You love the idea of like, if you like that, then you're cool too.
Then you like,
you love the idea of being cool yourself.
You love cool music and cool motorcycles and cool tattoos.
Yeah.
You don't like music.
Right.
So for me, like, yeah, what I like in music, I like, and I like it on such an instinctive and gut level that I don't even question it.
Sure.
And you know, okay. Hot take here. Like I don't get jazz. Like I don't.
That's great. That's great.
But it doesn't, you know, there was definitely a time where I felt, okay, if you're going to be a musician, you need to like jazz and you need to study jazz. And I sort of tried, but it was like pulling teeth with me.
Mm.
And also it's like, I never saw myself getting a jazz gig, wanting a jazz gig. So why am I working on jazz?
Yeah.
But even going back before that, like I just, for whatever reason, not whatever reason, I mean, I've thought about it. I think that it's too dissonant. And there's like, let's go back to the Beatles and Something.
Yeah.
Right. That song. Like for me, you couldn't change a note of that melody.
Right.
It's perfect. And every note inevitably leads to the next note.
Yeah.
And there's this
one of my all time favorite Beatles tunes and just tunes. Like I love that tune.
That's what I mean. It's, and there's just, and every time I hear it, I have the exact same emotional response, even though I know that it's going this note, this, you know, this melody leading into that. And that chord, I know it hits me the same way every single time.
Yeah.
And like in jazz, someone, you know, wow, that's the greatest solo. Check out this, you know, what this guy did over these changes. And to me, it's like, okay, that's impressive that he can do that. But every single note could have been a different note. So my brain goes, why do another take? And it'd be just, it'd be just as amazing.
Right, right.
But
there's no like,
it's not pinging.
There's no pinnacle of perfection here. They can only be achieved the one way.
And there's nothing that is ultimately hitting me emotionally. It's like, yeah, that it could have been that, or it could have been that. And that works and that works. And that's great. And that's amazing that it just doesn't hit me emotionally. It never has. I just think it's because it's so complicated. And in a way it's so random, not that it's random, there are rules and stuff like that. But like I said, the melody for Something to me could not be any different.
Sure.
But the best solo over whatever changes could have been played a million different ways.
Yeah. So when you go back out with the Dirty Knobs, and what part are you in the States on that?
Yeah, we go back out this Friday.
Okay.
Yeah, we play a beer fest in Simi Valley.
Nice.
Exactly.
I'm in. The Friday? Hold on. What date is that?
Let me look.
The 27th?
I'm sorry, it's Saturday. That's even better, right?
Yeah.
It's called
21 or 28?
That's the 28th.
Okay.
It's called the Happy Face Hills Festival.
Heck.
So then after that, so that's, let me see. Yeah, and then the following Monday, we fly to Seattle and we do like a little club date, and then we hook up with Chris Stapleton.
That's cool, man.
Yeah.
Do you like Stapleton? Have you checked out his records?
I mean, I'm not that familiar with his music, but I mean, what a singer.
Amazing singer. With that album, The Traveler, I must have had on repeat for probably about 4 months straight. Like, I loved that record. I haven't checked out the one after that too much.
Okay. He and Mike co-wrote a bunch of songs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. One of them's on our first album.
Nice.
A song called Fuck That Guy.
That was, who's the target? Who are they talking about?
Mike says, insert your guy here.
Oh, okay. It could be anybody.
Yeah, exactly.
Here's your own adventure.
Exactly. That was Stapleton's contribution to the song. He had the title.
Okay.
He's like, Mike, I got this title, but I don't know if I can finish it. And Mike's like, I can finish that.
Yeah, I got that. I got that.
And that is one we play, and you talk about like audience participation. It is awesome.
Oh, sure.
It is awesome. A lot
That's
of
cool.
Yeah.
You just have like the thousands of people yelling F that guy.
Exactly. So like Hollywood Bowl, I can't wait to see what that's like. Or even these Stapleton shows, maybe.
Yeah. So does he come out and join the Knobs?
I don't know how that's going to work. We haven't worked with him yet. So, yeah, I don't know if I doubt he'll come out. I couldn't see him coming. I mean, he actually sings on some songs of ours, too.
Okay.
So he'd come out and do that. But I wouldn't imagine he does that. But Mike might hang around and, you know, come out and play guitar solo.
That's during cool.
Set or something like that. But we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, I guess that'd make more sense for the opener to join the closer instead of the closer to come out before they've started their set yet.
Yeah, I did Henley did a tour with Stevie Nicks.
Oh, cool.
Stevie would usually, she was usually the second act. You know, it's like a co-headline thing.
Yeah.
But she was the second act. And but she would come out during our set.
That's
and
cool.
Our set. during my set. I'd be
Stevie, during my solo show.
I'd like, you know, look at her and be like, not yet. No,
hold on.
How about now? Yeah. But
back off.
Exactly. But she would come out and sing like a verse and some harmony in Hotel California, which is cool.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. That's cool. Lance, always a pleasure, man.
Yeah,
always
Ryan.
A pleasure.
Dude. Absolutely.
We'll stay in touch. I'm gonna come crash all your gigs that are on the West Coast.
I want you to, and
you say that now.
I do.
Let's see what happens at this beer garden first.
That's right. If you get a little sloppy, we'll see. Might have to outslop me.
Yeah. Okay. Challenge accepted.
Exactly. Cool. But yeah, let's definitely stay in touch, and I'll let you know. Whenever we're doing shows around here,
man, that'd be great. That'd be great, cool. Dude. All right, man. We'll be in touch.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, Lance.
Bye.
If you are enjoying the Bass Shed podcast, please hit subscribe wherever you are listening to it. I'm honored that this podcast has grown like it has because you all take the time out of your lives to listen to me rant and butcher last names. The podcast has grown. It is in the top 25% of podcasts. So thank you. Thank you all so much for listening. Lance Morrison. I love when he's on the show. I dig how transparent he is about where his mind's at and the things he struggled with in the past. Like, I can relate to all that. I think a lot of musicians and artists in general can relate to having that self-defeating kind of talk in the back of their head. And it's always comforting to hear players like Lance, who have a really, really impressive discography, speak about those things. So thank you, Lance. Thank you. That's cool. I like when guys are just really open about the humanity of where they're at within their career. I love that stuff. And it's part of why I started this thing. Stop by thedirtyknobs.com, click on tour dates in the top right hand corner and see if they are coming to a city near you. I'm excited to check them out at the Hollywood Bowl. That's going to be dope. The Dirty Knobs and Chris Stapleton, that's going to be a great show. It's going to be a good one. All right, folks, that's about all I got for this one. That about wraps her up. thanks as always for listening, and I will catch you on the next one in a minute.